Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close
the wall. Up the wall with our English dead.
Yes. This is that was the famous quote from Henry V, Shakespeare's Henry V, the Battle of Harfleur. We say it every time because it does feel a bit like we're about to fill up a breach in the radio world with our own dead.
Because, oh, English dead. Let's fill it up with English dead, not American dead.
But the quote is coming from an English person, so we would be kind of in the
metaphorically.
American, yeah, in the meta way. Yeah.
Yeah, but there was a revolution, so we're not English anymore. We speak English. No, we actually don't speak English. We speak American.
So we speak
American.
We were English until we revolved.
Right.
Okay. I suppose that makes sense.
The Beatles sang a song about that.
Yeah. You say we've got a revolution?
You say you want a revolution.
Yeah. Yep, that's the one. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, where we do impersonations and we attempt to be Paul McCartney and John Lennon very poorly, but we do attempt. Actually, we're here to be economists. We're here to talk to you about the world of finance in general. What's happened this week? What's happened this year? What's happened this 1,000 years? All those things are important, and they do help us plan. Not that we expect to be around 1,000 years from now, but wouldn't it be nice?
What? Speak for yourself, buddy.
I do. I try, mostly, to speak for myself. When I try to speak for other people, they call me a ventriloquist.
Yeah. I'm 7/10. I'm 7% of my way through 1,000 years.
Yeah, you'll get there. You'll get there. You just may not be aware of it. We don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Could be.
So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation with old Baldy here, Jeff McLaurin, younger but still not young Baldy, Jake McClure. We'd love to hear from you. The email address in here email address are Jeff@tpwc.com and Jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the Personal Wealth Coach. And so we've got some disclosures before we can do anything else. We're already almost 10 minutes into the hour and we haven't even started disclosing yet. So first disclosure is that the Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. But it's not just a radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That firm offers fiduciary investment advice. However, just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they have in any way approved it. /us. More like slashing. The SEC is good at disapproval. They don't know how to approve. They even, in their own writing, say they never approve anything.
They do approve of IPOs, ultimately.
Well, no.
They allow them.
They allow them. That's very different than approving them. So there's no approval even implied here. I think that's kind of laughable, but it's important. And the SEC is the one that wants us to make sure you know that. That they're not saying we're on the up and up, we're just registered with them. Cool. Okay. The other thing is that while the firm, the Personal Wealth Coach, gives fiduciary investment advice, the radio program, which actually has the people from the firm in it, can't give investment advice on the air. Because investment advice, we have to know who you are. We have to know your situation. And it would probably be a little breach of privacy to be talking about it in front of all the other listeners, all two of us that are listening out here. So all that says is that on the radio, we're giving educational information. We're actually going to try to teach you stuff.
Oh, no.
I know, it's hard.
Boring.
Open your brain. Learn. No, I want to sit on a Saturday and do something else. I've often said that the people that listen to our program on Saturday morning, they're just an oddball group. You're not watching cartoons or sports. All right. So you've got some disclosures you want to throw out there, too?
The information we present on this radio program is designed to be educational, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to its accuracy or completeness.
You said it fast enough.
Although we have obtained it from sources we deem to be reliable.
There you go. You said it fast enough, but the monotone needs work. You need to get less emotion in there. Let's see what we can do.
The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. We make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Perfect. And if you just change the channel to this channel in the middle of that, I think that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
All right. So what else do we have to say? What else? Oh, we don't pay for the radio program.
Yeah, we don't pay for the radio program.
The program somehow is being paid for by Town Square Media. They pay for all their airtime, and I guess they're paying for it with other advertisement. We don't advertise with them on the program. We do advertise for the program. So while we're advertising on KTEM, which we don't do on the rest of Town Square Media, we're just advertising for the radio program at 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. They advertise for our program at 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings too. So,
but we do have a conflict of interest.
More than one, I think. I think we've got more than one there. Go ahead.
Well, people who listen to the program might get to know us and like us and give us money.
That's true. And the clients that we already serve can listen to us on the air and get our take on what's going on.
That's the big one.
Yeah. So it's not like we're completely altruistic by being on here for 20 plus years free of charge, but it's 20 plus years free of charge. So come on, not completely altruistic is we're trying. Okay. We're trying. We've got some questions hanging out there. Two of them so far.
Yeah.
And we haven't even hit what happened this week in the market. So what happened this week in the market?
Well, I was in Oregon, so the market didn't happen.
Right. I think this week in the market, there were a group of people buying from a group of people that were selling.
Yes.
And on to the next subject.
Anyway, the S&P 500, affectionately known by us as the SPX, although I very rarely call it the SPX, but you have to define that because the S&P 500 can be defined different ways.
You rarely do it, but when you do, it is affectionately.
Yes, very affectionately. It ended Friday by rising almost 1%, actually 0.81, but that's close enough. But during the week, it was down. And why was it down? And it didn't get up enough that it overcame, it didn't get down enough, it didn't get up enough to overcome its downness. So it ended the week with a little bit of downness. I like that. And it fell 0.59%, which is not significant. But on Monday, it broke a record. So it fell 0.59% from its previous record on Friday, which is very confusing.
Yes.
Which means it's not down very much. But the folks at the newspapers and the Wall Street Journal and places like that have to write about something. And anyway, it closed at 44.41.67 if you keep up with such things.
Yes.
It is up 18.25% year to date. Now, why did it fall this week?
Because more people were trying to sell than were trying to buy.
Well, not necessarily more people, but there was more selling.
More shares. Yeah, more shares were being sold than there was an interest to buy them at the price they were being sold. Yeah.
You said it right, even though you mispronounced the word. You said more shells were being sold.
Yes, more shells were being sold.
That makes sense.
At the seashore by Sally.
Yeah. The SPACs are down quite a lot. Those are shells. Anyway, basically COVID-19 Delta has got the bears excited, and they kind of beat down on the bulls a little bit during the week. Everything keeps coming out, and they keep getting little anecdotal pieces of evidence that maybe a lot of people are going to get really sick, and a lot of people are getting sick, as a matter of fact. In some areas of the United States, the COVID contagion rate is higher than it was at the peak during the regular session of COVID in this after-season session. And that's a significant issue. A lot of the projections say this won't peak until October in the United States. And if it keeps on doing like it's doing, they're concerned that there will be lockdowns. And I can see that there might be, because where we were out on the West Coast, the emergency rooms were full. The hospitals are full. I understand that Scott & White is at 133% capacity for its ICU or for in general. I don't know.
In general, that's the bed capacity. Yeah.
So that extra 33% of people, I don't know where they're putting them. Maybe they put them in tents. I don't know. But the point is, we don't know how bad the Delta variant is going to get. One of the things we can say with a great deal of certainty, though, is it will only get so bad and then it'll get better. It's certainly not killing enough people to wipe out the population, and nobody so far that's gotten it has turned into a zombie. So those are very important issues.
Yes, that we know of. All of this information comes from sources we deem to be reliable, and we have heard no reliably deemed sources saying that zombies are occurring.
Right. So that's a good sign. Those of who are concerned at this pandemic is a zombie copies is called the zombie apocalypse.
I think it's just called the zombie apocalypse, but you could combine two awkward words into one much more awkward word if you'd like.
Okay.
Anyway. It sounds cool when you do that. I'm not trying to knock it. It's just that you're just making a more awkward word than we already had two awkward words to fill the spot.
And there's some good articles on that have come out this week we might want to talk about how long these pandemics last, and using the 1918 influenza epidemic.
Right.
Pandemic as an example.
But we can also look at polio and smallpox in other areas as examples as well. So there's some great stuff out there. Did we cover the market?
No.
Well, all right. You still have interest rates. You still have West Texas Intermediate.
I have the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index that we also follow. Draw 4.81%. Yeah. Now, the S&P 500, despite the fact the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index dropped 1.81%, closing at 2453.21, it's still ahead year-to-date with a 19.55% gain. Now, this is something that's important to understand about the market.
Only 19.55? What's the world?
Yeah. Well, it's more volatile than the S&P 500, which is interesting.
It's unusual. But
it's smaller. No, it's smaller stocks. And smaller stocks tend to be more volatile than larger stocks.
Right.
So mid-cap stocks tend to be more volatile than large-cap stocks. So it's still up more year-to-date than the S&P 500. It's real proud of that. It bragged about it, that it was down 1.81% for the week. Let's see. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, and that's worth discussing, and we've already got a question on that, really. It has to do with the Treasury market in general. Dropped to 1.261. And the bottom line to it is more money is seeking safe haven in U.S. Treasuries. In the world, there's a consensus among major investors. And by major investors, you're talking about nation states and billionaires.
Yep.
And big corporations. That the safest place to put your money in the world is in the U.S. dollar. And a lot of them, an awful lot of people think that a 10-year loaning money to the United States for 10 years at a loss is a really good idea at this point. And the reason was explained by Will Rogers.
It's a pretty good one. I like this quote.
1930s, he said, "Nowadays, people are far more concerned about the return of their money than the return on their money." And I think that's what we're seeing. A lot of people are very concerned, outside the United States particularly, that the coronavirus is going to devastate their economy, and they're finding some place where they can put money. And that's completely safe. And they're not buying gold. Gold prices have not soared. And in fact, gold prices have gone down a bit. They're not buying Bitcoin. They don't consider that particularly secure. Matter of fact, most people who the big money considers that particularly insecure, they're buying U.S. Treasuries. Now, that should tell you something. I presume most of the people who are listening to us, all both of them, are citizens of the United States or residents of the United States.
It's quite a presumption there, but it may be accurate.
But it boils down to the fact we have the most stable economic system and the most stable monetary system in the world by far. And I mean, when I say by far, and we'll get into that more during the rest of the show about why people believe that's true.
Let me interject here real quick. We do get a lot of downloads from China and Russia. We also get a lot across Europe and all over the United States. We don't
really
have very many in Canada or Mexico. We have more in Germany than we do there. Yeah.
Downloads or uploads?
Downloads. Like they downloaded our program from our website.
Oh, yeah. I see.
So you can't just say it's arguably.
I was kind of joking,
but we do have a lot of international listeners.
Should we be speaking in Chinese or German then?
No, I suspect they already speak English, or it would be a really strange 2 hours.
Well, I don't know. Strange 2 hours?
Yeah,
yes.
Our program is very strange if you can't understand. I mean, it's strange already.
If
you can't understand it, it's,
So the Treasury note yield fell to 1.261, which is not outrageously low compared with where it has been. It was 0.91 at the beginning of the year. But the dollar rose, the Treasury note yield fell, which means that if you happen to be holding a 10-year treasury note at that point, the price rose. That's what happened. That's what happens when the interest rates rise on bonds, is because the value of the bond is falling. When interest rates fall, it's because the value of the bond is rising.
Right.
And the treasury is issuing like next to no debt at all right now, because they passed the ceiling, actually. And the ceiling deadline went back into effect on July 31st. So the Treasury is not authorized to borrow any more money. So there's no new notes being issued.
But don't worry about it, because we have a budget bill that's expected to be passed maybe at the end of September.
Well, the budget doesn't start until October 1st, does it?
No, it doesn't. So that's the end of September is when the budget bill is coming. The year for the United States government starts October 1st, but if we can't issue debt between now and then, there might be some issues. Get the issues? If we don't issue, there might be issues.
I like that. Yeah. Anyway, West Texas Intermediate crude sank 8.36%, which is a large drop to 62.25. There's very simple reason for that one, actually. Well, there's two reasons for that. One, the dollar roses. When the dollar roses, that sounds War of the Roses. the dollar rose, which causes $1 to buy more barrels of oil, which means the price of oil goes down as the dollar goes up.
$1 will buy more of a part of a barrel of oil.
You're right. Yeah, well, very small barrels.
Very small barrels.
Yes.
Thimble barrels.
Sampler barrels, you know, like those little half beer.
Yeah, it's like a
glasses. That you
get. Yeah, what do they call those? A flight of? Could I have a flight of oil, please?
That'd be cool. Anyway, it sank to 62.25. Growing inventories and a rising dollar. Why does it have growing inventories? Apparently, the Delta variant is having an effect on people's driving habits. People are driving less. There's less demand for gasoline. Less demand for all the kind of stuff that makes vehicles move around.
We had a question last week of, was it a good idea for Biden to go and talk to OPEC about lowering the price of gasoline? And I had said, you know, it's a political move. It's a one group that might have a larger control of the output of oil and gas than the frackers, which are very disunited. It's not un-united.
They're in the United States.
If it's ununited, that's like saying un-united. So disunited group that are basically doing whatever is in their own best interest, which is good. So Biden then goes to OPEC and says, lower gasoline prices, please. And look what happened this week. Gasoline prices went down. Now, they're not connected, but in politics, this is one of those things that if you go to OPEC in January and prices come down in December, you can claim credit.
This is something
that every president since OPEC has existed has attempted. So is it a good idea? Well, it depends on what you mean by good. Politically, it's a fantastic idea. And this one had a result. They may not jump on it because next week the price of oil might go back up. Unlikely, but it could. And if they jump on this and say, look, we caused the price of oil to go down, then it won't work very well for them. So they may just wait and see if there's a trend and then take credit for it. We'll see.
So, that's the market wrap.
Okay. Well, John sent us an email here, and the email is, John, thanks for the email. His question is, what's the significance of the 530 spread? And that sounds like he knows his stuff. The 530 spread is something that less than 1% of the finance community follows this. But those that do follow it are extremely jargon oriented. They use words for things that we already have words for, but it makes them sound really important. It is an important gauge. What is the 530 spread? That sounds like something you'd put in a car or on a sandwich.
Now that's what happens when you eat supper early at 5:30.
Oh yeah, the 5:30 spread. Here it is for you, folks. Here's the good spread. What it is, it's the difference in interest rates between the 5-year and the 30-year in the U.S. Treasury market. And they watch it, even though there's not a consistent ratio. There's not a consistent difference. They watch it to see what the kind of consensus in the bond market is on the expectation for long-term inflation. Because if we've got higher interest rates now, and we say that's because, you know, we're afraid that inflation is going to be there, so we're selling bonds and buying stocks, that would cause interest rates to go up. Well, 30-year interest rates, as a different from 5-year interest rate, is by some people believed to be a good indicator of what they think the long-term inflation rate's going to be.
I prefer tea leaves.
Yeah, if the spread is very small, if there's not a lot of difference between the two numbers, then the consensus is we probably don't have high inflation so long as the 5-year rate is low. Is this complicated enough? It gets more complicated, so we're going to jump out of the nitty-gritty for a second and say that it is one of dozens of indicators that we look at in inflation. One of dozens, because it isn't that important an indicator. We did have a drop in that spread after the Fed minutes in June where they said, hey, we're going to be tapering back and we don't think there's much in the way of inflation ahead. But other stuff was going on at the same time. That's one where we can say that's probably the Fed minutes that caused that drop. But what it was is the consensus saying we don't expect long-term inflation to be out there.
Basically, the Fed started talking about reducing purchases and doing things like they're not too concerned about inflation. They think it's transitory and they believe it's transitory in their minutes. And there's a lot of evidence that it is transitory. So people said, hey, there's not going to be high inflation into the future. So we're going to sell our 30-year treasuries. No, we're going to buy 30-year treasuries. That drops the interest rate. Again, it comes back to the fact that people trust dollars so much right now, trust the U.S. monetary system so much, they're willing to sink a lot of money for 30 years into the U.S., knowing that inflation is almost certainly going to be higher over the next 30 years than the interest they're being paid.
So it's in essence a negative interest rate. It's just a better negative interest rate than like Germany's charging or being charged. I don't know how do you pay a negative interest?
You pay them back less than they gave you.
That's just amazing. I'm gonna require that. Yeah. So this is still breaking my brain, even though it shouldn't. This is something. Just as a side note, let's time out for a second on this subject because that subject's a good. Well, let's just answer. What's the significance of the 530 spread? Not majorly, but it makes for good articles in the Wall Street Journal. There's not a great deal of significance to it. It hasn't been shown to be consistently an indicator of anything except for what's happening at this very moment. So it's not a leading indicator. It's not a lagging indicator. And I'm not sure that it indicates anything at this moment except that one is paying different than the other.
A positive 530 spread indicates that there's a positive yield curve. We can say that with a great deal of certainty.
Right. And to come back to the concept of what's the significance. It's not that significant. What is significant when it comes to inflation? And these are numbers. Short term, you can have thousands, maybe millions of things that could lead to inflation or deflation. It's completely not possible to track that stuff. Long term, there's only productivity and demographics. If you're more productive, you have less inflation, unless the government's going nuts. So even long-term, government spending kicks in as well. And that's part of that is how we measure our GDP, how we measure inflation in general. It gives a greater weighting to government spending than really it should. But all that being said, what we're looking at, what is pretty clear across the board is that our productivity is increasing and we expect it to increase exponentially in the next decade. That's the kryptonite of inflation. So if you can increase your productivity faster than the price of the product goes up from the supplies, then you can lower the price of the product even when the ingredients are becoming more expensive. And we're in that mode right now. How do we make more money with what we've got? And once the supply chain issues, and those are all the millions of things that are leading to short-term inflation, do you mind just for a moment? I'm going to give an analogy that I gave to some folks this week, and I think it was a really good one.
You've been known to tell me that I mind very poorly.
All right.
So I'm not going to mind.
Okay. You don't mind. It don't matter. It's good. Okay. So imagine that you are a distributor of widgets. Stuff is a better economic term than widget, because I've never seen a widget, but I've seen a lot of stuff. So you're the distributor for a lot of stuff, and you've got a big warehouse. And your warehouse, you order things to it, you order stuff from multiple suppliers of stuff. And you go directly to the source in a lot of cases. Sometimes you have to go to another distributor to get your stuff. But most of the time, you're going direct to the manufacturer. So they're shipping you your stuff. Well, all your truck drivers recently got sick. So you're having trouble delivering your stuff to the places that actually sell the stuff to the public.
All of them didn't get sick.
Not all of them, just a lot of them. So you're having trouble delivering your stuff out of your warehouse. So your warehouse is full. The manufacturers of stuff have not had a problem with their truck drivers. So they've been stocking your warehouse. Now you don't have any room left. Are you planning on ordering more while your warehouse is bursting to the seams? No. You stop. Hey, guys, stop sending me stuff. I don't want stuff right now. I'm selling stuff. I've got too much stuff. I'm just using stuff because I like it. Some people have said I'm full of stuff.
Well, there is a product called Great Stuff.
Right. So we've suspended the stuff from the manufacturers. The distributor is now trying to distribute the stuff, but they're still having trouble with their truck drivers. Now, back at the manufacturer, they realize all the warehouses that have been ordering stuff from them have stopped ordering stuff from them, and they've got all these truck drivers on the payroll. And they say, sorry, guys, nobody's ordering stuff right now. We're going to have to lay you off. I know that last month you were in extra demand and we only hired you last month, but this month, demand has dropped horribly. We don't know what's going on. You're going to need to just go on unemployment or something. Hopefully, we can hire you back. So they get laid off. Well, the warehouse of stuff has been searching for truck drivers. And suddenly, all these truck drivers come onto the market. And they go, we'll hire all of you. So they hire all the truck drivers. And the truck drivers all show up and start distributing the stuff from the warehouse. They're taking it to the grocery stuff stores and the bars and restaurants that sell stuff. Then the warehouse starts to empty. And the distributor says to the manufacturer, last month we said we didn't need any more stuff. Well, we need some more stuff now. We're actually able to get it out. And the demand is a lot higher than we expected because we hadn't been able to get it out there. So we would really like to order double the amount of stuff that we ordered last time because we have space to store it now. Well, the manufacturers say that would be great, but we have no truck drivers. So then the warehouse can't get its supply and it can't distribute to the people that sell the stuff. So they have to lay off the truck drivers who then get manufactured purchase. The manufacturers say, come back and work for us. They distribute back to the warehouse. The warehouse fills up. This is not a never-ending cycle. This is something that people figure out. This happens only once or twice. But that's where we are in this cycle. This is where the supply chain, when we say there's slack in it in one place, if it's too tight in the other, they say, oh, we can use this other slack from over there, but that slack's needed by somebody else later. We'll get it figured out, and in the process, we'll get better at it. So these stuff manufacturers and the stuff distributors will get better at figuring out when and where and how they distribute.
The other factor is we're used to, over the last 10 years, a pretty steady state economy.
Right.
The economy grew at a fairly steady state. There were minor changes here and there that moved the stock market around. But everything was pretty steady state. Supply and demand. Supply would grow. Demand would grow. Everything was just in time. It was all predictable. It was all steady. It was cool. And we got used to that fact. We had very low inflation. because we'd had a decade to build up our supply chains to meet exactly the demand that was coming along.
And when we had a demand spike, it was like 1% different than, oh, look at the spike in demand over here. And we'd get very excited about that. And are we going to be able to deal with it? Yes, we're good. We have technology.
But with the pandemic, everything has changed and it's still changed. We don't know what's coming next. We really don't. There's two things happened with the pandemic, one of which was, in a sense, predictable. If you have a pandemic, this is going to happen. Demand would fall off and then it would blossom back up again. It would blossom back up in a different space and then it would sag back down again. But there's only a limited amount of ability to predict what was going to happen in a pandemic, because the last time we had a pandemic in this side was in 1918 through 1920, actually went into 21. And as a result, things are changing very, very quickly. But then, because of the speed of communication that we have today, the digital communication of email and Twitter and electronic or digital advertising and Amazon doing weird stuff. See, I'm using stuff.
Stuff is an important economic term.
It is.
I plan on banning widgets from now on and just using stuff.
Cool. All this was going on, and the American consumer, who is definitely the 800-pound gorilla in the room, changed their buying habits. I mean, they changed their buying habits massively. First, they saved up a tremendous amount of money. They were given a lot of money, too, but that's not the big thing. They saved a tremendous amount of money. And then when they came back out of saving a tremendous amount of money in fear, they started buying things that were different than they bought before. And, for instance, all of a sudden, a very large percentage, relatively speaking, of Americans decided they needed a new car. Well, that occurred after the chip industry had switched over to making chips for video games because people had stopped buying cars. And an unusually large number of people decided they wanted a new car. And new cars today are about half computer, half automobile. And the half that is computer is pretty complicated. And there was a shortage of chips. Well, it's gotten worse recently, by the way, because the Delta variant apparently has hit factories in Malaysia. Now, what's Malaysia got to do with automobiles? Oddly enough, a lot of the chips are assembled into components that are put in cars, the little electronic circuit boards and so on that go into car, that go into automobiles. A lot of that's done in Malaysia. Well, Malaysia is having a terrible surge of COVID-19 Delta variant. And as a result, a lot of the factories are getting shut down because there's just too many people in there with COVID and the hospitals are overwhelmed and people are dying. And now Toyota, for example, just had to shut down 30 to 40% of its total capacity across the world because they don't have enough of the components. The chips are pretty much starting to heal themselves and come in, but they don't have the components the chips are made from because the Malaysian factories are shutting down. And you can expect this to continue for at least another year, I would say. That's just an example.
Yeah. That is what we're seeing for the future. Manufacturing capability is improving. Man, that sounds like eco jargon when I say it. Manufacturing capability is improving. Sounds very boring. What it means, there are factories being constructed in the desert. There are factories being constructed in the jungle. There are, let's do this Dr. Seuss, if you will. Factories are being constructed all over the place. A lot of them in the United States, which is a very major transition from what we were seeing in the past. When chip manufacturers are choosing to manufacture in the United States, even though our labor prices are significantly higher, still, you know, people say China's labor lost its labor price advantage. Well, compared to America, they have not. Nowhere close. We still charge a lot more per hour than most of the other manufacturing folks in the world. So when people choose to make a factory in the United States, they have to take that into account. They have to say it's going to cost more for the people. So they're hiring robots. And the robots are, robot is a term that can be applied to anything that's roboticized, the car or a CNC or a manufacturing factory. The entire factory can be automated. Is it a big robot? Maybe more like thousands and thousands of robots, but they're working together on a network. So it could be considered one major robot. And that's going to make the cost of labor drop. Elon Musk has said something that most futurists have said, going all the way back to the creating of Star Trek, that at some point technology will make it so that labor will be a choice for everybody at some point. Because if the robot can do it essentially for free, the prices for everything is going to drop, and you're not going to be able to compete in the labor market against the robot. The only way you'll be able to compete in a labor market against a robot is by claiming that it's handmade. And that's not competing. Now you're in a niche market where people are saying, I will pay more for the story of a human that made this thing for me. And we see that already. So if we're looking at knives, have you looked at butcher knives lately? I was looking at one for a gift and my eyes just about popped out of my head from the prices. Have you seen the prices on these things?
No, I haven't.
Steel prices are up, that's true, but high quality butcher knives, chef style, can be hundreds and hundreds of dollars. The most expensive ones are handmade. And when you
In Japan,
in the United States, in Germany, places where there's like a long history of craftsmanship. So these handmade on-site location, you know, in a blacksmith forge, and they're carefully folding the steel and so on. When you look at the steel under a magnifying glass, at a high magnification, under a microscope, the steel that's made by machine, that's pounded by the machine, that is baked and all the things, all the entire process of taking steel from rock to a finished product, it's higher quality. There's no doubt about that. The machine did it better. But the handmade one is going to be more expensive. And the reason why it's going to be more expensive is at some point, if you're double the sharpness of a razor blade, it doesn't matter. It's still going to be used as a razor blade. If the machine makes it that much better, it doesn't matter. If you can make something beautiful that has a story with it, then you can compete with a machine on labor. It's a choice.
It's because of the fact that our incomes are going up.
Right. So all that...
When you have excess money, you buy the story.
Yeah.
When you don't have excess money, you buy the fact.
Excess money changes. You could be making the same amount of money, but if the price of all your food drops, and it has been over the last 100 years, then the story is something that you'll pay for. And that happens in the United States, even in the poverty level. When people are making purchases, they still have enough excess money to purchase extra priced things that have a story. This is across the board. Otherwise, you wouldn't buy Nike over a generic brand tennis shoe.
Gives you bragging rights.
Yeah. So this is something that's just true behaviorally, and inflation has an impact on all of that. What's really happening with this magnified growth in our manufacturing capability is the supply chains are getting shorter. And as they get shorter, they get more efficient. The longer the supply chain, we had the most fine-tuned supply chain that wrapped around the planet 20 different times and was kind of networked out. And you just take a little one link of that massive chain of wrapped network all the way around the planet 13 times, you break it, and the whole thing fell apart.
That's happened in Malaysia. I didn't even know that components for cars were manufactured in Malaysia, but apparently almost all vehicles have components manufactured in Malaysia.
So
without that one component, the car won't work.
We're going to have more redundant supply chains, and we're going to have more efficient supply chains. We're going to understand them better because enough people are spending enough money on this right now going, we got to do this better. People are studying this because there's a lot of money on the line. So it's going to improve. There's just no doubt in my mind about that. We've got to play some commercials. We got a question Roger sent us out earlier in the hour. So we're going to get that. It has to do with Afghanistan. But we'll be back.
If you have a question for us or a thought or a comment, send it to either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com and we'll address it on the air.
Cool. And we got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.
Promises, promises, promises.
we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure.
That's easy for you to say.
It is. Well, we've practiced a long time saying our names, so it does get easy to say.
It does.
We have a question from Roger, and it's a easy question to answer. The question is, with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, especially the way it occurred, will that withdrawal embolden China? By the way it occurred, I mean overnight abandonment of Bagram Air Base without telling the Afghans and the rapid collapse of the Afghan army, etc. I mentioned this last week. We've talked about this over the two decades of the involvement that we've had in Afghanistan. Nearly two decades. It's very close. The Taliban's still out there. When we leave, the Taliban's going to take over. This isn't something that should surprise anyone. It was part of, you know, it's the reason why we haven't left, is that they're still there. And if we leave, they'll be just come right back out. Well, the other alternative is to wipe out the population. Well, we don't do that. That's not generally considered a nice thing for people to do, no matter what reason you might have. That's not acceptable. So they're coming back. Will that embolden China? There's a very easy one-word answer. I bet you know what it is.
No.
Well, I would say yes.
I would say no.
I would say it will embolden China on its diplomatic front, and it will scare the socks off of them on its Belt and Road project. How's that?
Well, you know, there was a solution to Afghanistan. General Curtis LeMay had the same solution for Vietnam.
Which is?
Nuke them till their teeth glow in the dark.
Yeah, that would have been a solution for someone.
Yeah, and so we didn't do that. Anyway, the point is, Afghanistan is the big thing right now, just like when we pulled out of Vietnam in a chaotic sense and left the Viet Cong with all the equipment that we left them, and the same noises were made. I'm old enough to remember that very clearly. Remember all the same, only they remained in the newspaper rather than on the internet, but still, it was the Democrats who were making those noises, because it was a Republican president who pulled out of Vietnam and was a collapse and a debacle and a collapse. The point is, Afghanistan has eaten alive. It ate Russia. The Soviet Union's collapse. The key point in the Soviet Union's collapse was Afghanistan.
Yeah.
When the Romans invaded Afghanistan, they had a legion go in there and just was eaten. It just disappeared. Was gone. Was eaten by the Afghanis. And it was the beginning of the decline of the Roman Empire. When the British went in there, they attempted to conquer Afghanistan and civilize it. And it was the beginning of the decline of the British Empire. Did I say British? Roman Empire and then British Empire.
Yeah.
This has been a real pattern through history. The fact that we are emerging stronger than we went in.
Yeah. Afghanistan is known as the graveyard of empires.
And if we continue to do what we're doing, there's no evidence that it weakened the United States to go into Afghanistan. It's a sad thing, but it didn't weaken us to go in there or to get out. And everybody winds up getting out of Afghanistan. But it was the Democrats who were howling when we went in that it was a quagmire and we shouldn't go in there. And in retrospect, they should have listened to Douglas MacArthur. He said, never get involved in a land war on the Asian continent. And every one we've gotten involved in on the Asian continent has been one we've sad about.
Now, I could come at this from a completely different angle. And you asked about, will it embolden China? That's a complicated. And I said, well, let's do a very simple one-word answer. That was definitely tongue-in-cheek. There's no simple answer to that. China will be emboldened on some fronts and terrified on others, because strategically, they've just been put in a very difficult situation with security along there. The Taliban's not known for their peaceful ways. That's
what?
Yeah, I know. It's shocking. So that's a thing. But to come at this from a different direction, when people say, you know, we're not in this for nation building, we're not trying to build a nation, and this is the longest war that we've ever been in, and you know, the stuff that gets said all the time about this, I have to point some things out. We still have troops in Japan and Germany and the Philippines. Why? Well, it's because we left them there because we were afraid if we took them out that some other nasty power would fill the vacuum. So you could define our role in Germany and Japan as being still part of World War II, if you wanted to. And that there are still, get this, insurgent attacks against American troops in Germany and in Japan. Now, usually it involves something benign like eggs or being hit in the face or spit on or that sort of thing. But for the 15 years after the war, it was much more serious than that. Maybe even 20 years after the war, it was pretty, pretty serious. We did the Marshall Plan in Europe and in Japan, where we pumped money in and really, really did nation building. We never did that with Afghanistan. We didn't do it with Iraq. We installed within the first year of our uninstalling the previous regime, we helped them install a different regime, which is just full of corruption all the way across the board. You know how long MacArthur served with all of the powers of the Emperor of Japan after World War II? Five years. You can't just take out people in charge and put in new people in charge and throw a bunch of money at it and say, that's it, it's done. You have to plan the thing out and you have to do it very carefully. And we didn't do that in Iraq or Afghanistan. We didn't do it in Vietnam. We did it to some extent with Korea, and we absolutely did it in Germany and Japan, which is we said, well, you break it, you buy it. And maybe they attacked us first, but we're going to go over there and we're going to make it a place where they're going to be our allies in the future, not our enemies. And lo and behold, what do we have? You know, people may argue that Germany was reluctant to make deals with Donald Trump or with Barack Obama or name whatever, but they are in no way attempting to attack us. In fact, they're one of our great trading partners. And the quibbles that we have with them are on whether or not we should do something relatively small and benign, not whether or not we should go to war tomorrow. So what happened? It's leaving a power vacuum that the Taliban's filling up. Will it embolden China? Absolutely. Will it embolden Russia? Absolutely. On their diplomatic, on their social media fronts, they have laughing material. They have finger-pointing material for the next couple of decades. This is great stuff for them. When it comes to the Belt and Road that already is traveling through some pretty scary stuff and China spending a lot of money on it, it just got scarier. Their strategic investment in that whole area was built around the concept that America wouldn't be able to get out of Afghanistan. They wouldn't have the intestinal fortitude to leave because it would leave such a nasty thing when they leave. Well, they being us, and we just did it. And it was a plan made by Donald Trump and by Joe Biden. So if you're a Republican and you're angry, be angry at Donald Trump. And if you're a Democrat and you're angry, be angry at Joe Biden. And if you want to just be angry at somebody to be angry at somebody, you can choose anybody you want. Anybody. Just choose somebody randomly. I'm not advocating that, by the way. But if you like being angry, you really don't need a selection choice here. And were bad decisions made in the war? Yes, absolutely. All the way through. Were good decisions made in the role? Yep, absolutely. All the way through. That's what war is. And the consequences are always bad. There's never a happy ending when it comes to war. This is a great thing. Going to mangle the quote, and I'm not even sure who to attribute it to, but the statement is the only thing sadder than winning a battle is losing one. And we're about out of time. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend, real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where we've got recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. We've got links to podcasts. You can read our newsletter and sign up for our newsletter. You can use the contact form, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com. We also have podcasts at all of your favorite podcast providers. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.